What is it that you're looking at with prions?
So right now we're using a number of techniques. One is called NMR spectroscopy, or nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy. We're also using mass spectrometry. We're using things called circular dichroism, which is another form of optical spectroscopy. All of these things are biophysical techniques that allow us to actually assess or measure the structure of prions at an atomic scale. And they can give us actually an exquisitely detailed picture of the shape of the protein, the shape of the molecule. Prions are naturally helical, meaning they look a little like a bunch of springs stuck together. But when they misfold, they turn from a helical protein to something that's actually called a beta strand or a beta sheet. And the beta sheet is essentially a bunch of ribbons. And in fact, silk is an example of a fiber that is made up almost exclusively of beta sheets. So when prions go from the helix to a beta sheet, we say that they convert or they misfold. And this is something that proteins will often do, and normally the body gets rid of them. But in the case of prions, when they misfold, they go from the helix to the beta sheet, they aggregate and they actually become toxic. And that's what causes the disease. What we're really interested in is how does that helical protein go to that beta sheet? What triggers it? What's the process? It's like, you know, how can you take a spring and pull it in different ways and make it look into a look like some kind of nice neat ribbon, which has sort of a pleated structure to it? We're trying to use those techniques to actually see that process in real time, to measure that process in whatever way we can, and in so doing, if we can understand it, we might have a way of stopping it.
The prions, if they misfold, is it every case of misfolding that could lead to disease, or are there some instances where they fold and it's okay, and then other times they fold and it's not okay?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Proteins will spontaneously misfold or unfold all the time. In fact, in your body, prion proteins will, and any other protein, will misfold or unfold every few seconds. Most proteins will spring back to their original conformation and stay that way and unfold and refold spontaneously. But in the case of prions, this is occasionally they misfold in a way that doesn't allow them to recover, and they can never come back to the structure that they once were. What's more is that once they've misfolded, they tell other prions to misfold the same way, and that sort of propagates, kind of like the way a virus propagates through a bunch of cells when they're infected. The prion misfolding behaves very much like a viral infection, where it spreads from a focus where the first instance of misfolding happened. This happens only very rarely in terms of spontaneous prion diseases, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. It might happen in 1 in 1 million, 1 in 2 million people. So it's a very rare instance, and it's just a bit of bad luck. It's like being struck by lightning 2 or 3 times. So normally it's a natural process, and normally our bodies can get rid of the misfolded proteins very easily. But occasionally it just doesn't happen, and it causes the disease.
What have you found then with your investigation?
Well, we've been exploring how the prion starts unfolding and starts converting. And we've tracked this again, using a number of different techniques. And we've identified that first, the back end of the molecule, or the tail end of the molecule, seems to be the part that gets disrupted or unfolded first. We've also identified that when the prion protein starts aggregating and starts converting from this all helical form to this beta sheet or beta-like form, It aggregates first in what we call dimers or pairs, and then in tetramers, which is sets of four, and then ultimately to what seem to be octamers or groups of eight molecules. And that these aggregates are all hung together near the back end from the last about 70 residues. And these 70 residues all come very, very close together and are almost impenetrable by other molecules, by water, by proteases or other things that can cut into them. So they produce this insoluble, tightly massed core that can't be cut, that can't be broken down. Then these octamers eventually start forming fibrils or threads. And this process is very mysterious and seems to take weeks, months perhaps. And those structures and those shapes are things that we're starting to explore now, but that is a very, very difficult problem. But this stepwise process of unraveling near the back end of the protein, this aggregation process, this is the first time I think people have seen this, and I think we have some pretty solid evidence now that supports this kind of process. So it gives us insights of what parts we have to stop. It gives us some insights of what might trigger the prion misfolding process. So it's exciting in the sense that now that we have this picture or this little movie, we might be able to start thinking of ways of treating or stopping it with certain small molecule drugs.
Well, you talked about it happening spontaneously. But what about the case where we're infected by outside sources? So, for example, the concern over mad cow somehow transmitting from the cow to humans. What's happening there to develop and spread the disease?
So what prion diseases and what makes them very distinct from any other disease is first that they are diseases not caused by bacteria or viruses, but caused purely by a protein. The other thing about prion diseases is that some of them appear to be transmissible, just like a viral disease or a bacterial disease, like the flu or a cold. And that's unprecedented. It's seen in no other protein folding disease. And there are other protein folding diseases that people are aware of. Alzheimer's disease is a protein misfolding disease. Parkinson's is a protein misfolding disease. Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, is a protein misfolding disease. But none of those diseases are transmissible. None of them are infectious. Prion diseases are infectious, meaning that if someone were to eat prion-infected material from a cow, or in the when prion diseases were first discovered, if you're a cannibal and you eat people's brains who've also been infected with the disease, or more recently, if prion-infected surgical instruments are used in surgery on the brain, you can pass the infectious prions to another individual. So the concern with the mad cow disease is that people eating contaminated beef or beef parts could develop and actually did develop the disease. And this is called variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, or VCJD. And the big worry is that if, in fact, the whole cattle herd became infected, then hundreds, thousands of people could be infected in turn and would die. So right now, people have established surveillance to monitor the cattle herds to make sure that they don't develop the disease, and to also change the rendering practices so that infectious material or parts of cattle that would be infectious aren't used in the preparation of foods that humans would eat. So this prevention is certainly the best way of actually making sure that we don't get VCJD. But it is the same process, that same conversion process. Those prions coming from the cattle arrive, they get into our bodies, they seek out the other prions that are naturally in our bodies, and they convert them. They spontaneously force our own prions to misfold and thereby spread the disease. But that process is probably very similar to what we have seen in the test tube in terms of the analytical techniques we've used to look at the conversion process. It's just that it's come from an outside source, sort of to seed the process.
If you're looking at this at the atomic level, then, the way you would using nanotechnology, does it mean that once you get down to that level, that the parts, like a protein is a protein is a protein, no matter where it comes from?
That's right. Different proteins from different organisms will have different sequences, is what we say. But a bovine or cow prion looks identical to a human prion. The native form, the natural form, they both look helical. If we showed you pictures of the two, you couldn't tell them apart. Even if we had experts looking at them, they couldn't tell them apart. Their sequence differs in a small, subtle way. And so if you look very, very carefully, you'd see how they have slightly different atomic structures. But when they misfold, they look the same or nearly identical. And the unfolding process is probably largely the same between the two species. So it's essentially like being contaminated, whether it was from a bovine prion or a human prion that's been misfolded. Both will lead to the same result, and both will lead to that spontaneous transmission, that spontaneous misfolding.
With what you found out now about how this works, where does that lead you in terms of future research?
So now that we have a better idea about what the initial steps to prion misfolding are, we'd also like to understand a little bit more about the actual structure of the misfolded prion. So we've got the first steps, if you want, the first few steps of someone taking off from an race. We'd like to see how they finish the race. And we want to see what it looks like when the conversion process is completed. So we're currently on a research project over the next 2 years to characterize the structure of that fully misfolded, aggregated, infectious prion form. But we're also branching that into another area, which is to say, okay, now we understand the process, or at least the initial stages. Are there ways of stopping it? Are there ways of identifying small molecules, drug leads that could actually prevent it? We also understand more about the early infectious and the early toxic forms. And it appears that the tetramer, that group of four proteins, and the octamer, that group of eight proteins, seems to be both highly toxic and the principal seed that leads to infection. So this would suggest that these might be useful vaccine candidates. So if we can make these aggregates and stabilize them, we could try and see if we could produce antibodies, or to try and structure them so that they could be used as vaccines. And in that way, we would have a preventative treatment or a therapeutic vaccine that could be used to treat humans or animals that may have already started initial development of the disease. So whether it's a small molecule drugs or a vaccine therapy, those are two areas that we're pursuing, and they are being pursued because of this basic research that we were able to do and the basic discoveries we were able to make about how that initial unfolding happens.
How does metabolomics fit into this?
So this is another area that we're exploring, which is how do we identify if someone has a prion disease? And usually the current method is for if it's an individual, if you've been identified as having Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, it's too late. Typically, already at that stage, you're seriously ill and there's no hope of recovery. Similarly for cattle, the only way we can identify cattle with CJD is if they've already started collapsing and falling and are seriously infected and may have already infected other animals. Same thing with chronic wasting disease, which is a prion disease for deer and elk. We can't identify until it's too late and it's started to spread. So if you could identify the disease, just like if you could identify cancer or heart disease long before the symptoms show up, then you could potentially treat the disease. So we're currently using metabolomics or techniques that detect small molecule metabolites in blood and urine of animals that have a prion disease to see what changes actually happen before the disease manifests itself, before you see the symptoms. So the hope is that if we could find a set of what we call biomarkers, metabolites, or proteins that seem to be a little askew or out of whack, that they might be signals, just like, you know, glucose is a signal of early stage, glucose in the blood is early stage diabetes. So if we could look for a small molecule, maybe it's, you know, a trimethylamine or something like that, that's elevated or decreased in early stages of prion disease, that might signal A, the development of the disease, and B, a chance to treat either the animal or the person with some therapy to stop the disease, cure them of the disease, and also prevent the spread, particularly in the case of deer and elk and chronic wasting disease.
Do you have any sense at this time of what those biomarkers might be?
We've identified, and other groups have identified, a few proteins that can show up in the urine, and they seem to be related to some control over the stress response. In terms of some small molecules, there's a couple that people have identified, and we're starting to identify as well. One in particular called myo-inositol, which is a small molecule. Interestingly, people actually found that myo-inositol could actually be used to treat Alzheimer's disease. So this small molecule may be a physiological response that our body is producing to help unfold or break apart the prion aggregates. So again, it's showing up as possibly a biomarker, but it's also perhaps our body's attempt to fight off the disease at its earliest stages. So we'll see. I mean, it's something we're going to have to explore over the next few months.
One of the things that has kind of been brought out in the popular press recently is that people who eat turmeric, so, Indian type foods, tend to have very little incidence of Alzheimer's in their populations, whereas here, where we don't include that in our diets, that we have very high incidence of Alzheimer's. What about something like that?
Yeah, those. I think this is a fascinating thing, whether it's Alzheimer's or even prion diseases, looking for molecules that potentially prevent the aggregation. Evidently, our bodies do produce molecules, myo-inositol being one, trimethylamine oxide is another one, which also is produced by the body to stop, and then things that we can eat. There are even drugs, tetracycline has been found, or a variant called doxycycline has actually been found to help prevent the formation of prion aggregates with people with CJD or Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Turmeric may also have similar effects in that it disrupts the beta sheet structure that you'll find in beta amyloids that form in Alzheimer's disease. So there is a potential that something that's, you know, already out there, already used, very abundant, whether it's turmeric or whether it's capsaicin or whether it's tetracycline, which is a commonly used drug, these may in fact have a dual role, an unexpected application in being able to either prevent or disrupt prion diseases or other protein misfolding diseases like Alzheimer's.
I'm thinking about species barriers. Some animals tend to be more susceptible to prion diseases as opposed to others. Do you have a sense, now that you're looking at this very, very small scale, of what might contribute to this barrier between the species?
Yeah, the species barrier is a real puzzle for prion biology. Hamsters are very susceptible. Rabbits appear to be almost unsusceptible or immune to prion diseases. There are certain mutations in humans that seem to make people more susceptible to prion diseases or less susceptible to prion diseases, sort of give you resistance. Same thing has been identified for sheep. It's called scrapie in sheep, which is a prion disease. The fact that we've identified or people have identified specific mutations that seem to provide resistance to the disease means that we can and are looking at the molecular structures that lead to that resistance. And some preliminary data that other people have collected suggests that these mutations or changes in some cases stabilize the protein so that it's less inclined to unfold or misfold. In other cases, they actually loosen the protein. And in that case, it just means the protein is probably more easily discarded if it misfolds. So those are in part related to species barriers as well as the resistance. Some cases, the prions, because they have a slightly different sequence, when they come up to a prion of, say, the host species, they won't misfold the host prion in quite the correct way or quite the incorrect way. Other times where species are very susceptible, evidently the very structure, the very nature of their prion sequence or their prion protein makes it very susceptible to being converted by any other prion from any other species, as it is the case with hamsters. These ones are very tough issues to look at a molecular scale because we're involving mixing molecules. And to study processes, we need very, very pure systems, very clean. So we like to look at a single species at a time. Still, you know, the challenge of the species barrier is one of the more vexing ones, and I hope we can try and use some of the models and some of the atomic details that we've got to help explore that, but that's going to be a tough one.
If we look at the big picture right now, I always find it just quite fascinating that we started off a few years ago looking at prions because we were worried about mad cows. That seems to have fallen by the wayside as it's come under control. But what it's led us is this whole new area where we're seeing that prion folding diseases, that prions are involved in so many human health concerns. What does that say to you about what the future holds?
I think, it's misfolding is actually the thing that's there. The prions are quite specific to just certain numbers of diseases or a certain small number of diseases, but misfolding of other proteins, so the beta amyloid protein, when it misfolds, causes Alzheimer's, and that's going to affect one in three of us. Alpha-synuclein, another protein in the brain, when it misfolds, that causes Parkinson's disease. A tau proteins, if they misfold, they also cause Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. Superoxide dismutase, if it misfolds, it causes Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS. And we're seeing similarities in how prion proteins misfold and how these other proteins misfold. And we're seeing similarities in how prion diseases propagate through the nervous system, the same way that these amyloid diseases propagate through the nervous system, causing Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or ALS. So yes, studying this rather rare or obscure disease has actually shown many people the similarities to other very chronic, very, very important, very widespread diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or ALS. And they may suggest not only treatments or therapies, but also might hint at ways of diagnosing the diseases earlier. So yeah, it's a classic example of how maybe, exploring a tiny area, what might seem obscure, could have profound and substantial benefits to many other areas of medicine and disease applications. It's the same thing that happened with cancer research. Many of the most important discoveries in cancer research were made with people exploring the behavior of yeast and bacteria. And we tend to forget that. And it underlines the importance of basic science, making probably the most important contributions to applied science and the discovery of drugs and cures and diagnostic tools.
Thank you very much, David.
You're welcome.